Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Sarah Rowan, former first grade teacher and member of the executive board of Eden Alternative, a national nonprofit that seeks to improve the lives of elders and their caregivers through education, consultation, and outreach. This program, given as the annual Dr. Chuck Powell Memorial Lecture, presented by the Department of Gerontology at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, October 2, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Julie Masters, chairman of the Department of Gerontology at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Our dear friend Sarah Rowan is an inspirational speaker and noted life advocate for individuals walking with forgetfulness. Sarah has traveled far and wide to deliver a message of hope, comfort, and inspiration, things that make a difference for those affected by Alzheimer's disease or any other form of dementia. Sarah began promoting quality of life issues after her husband, Dr. Joseph Rowan, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. As Joseph's primary care partner for almost 10 years, Sarah has firsthand experience with forgetfulness care and the joys and difficulties that are faced every day. Through this experience, Sarah began to view this journey as profound and sacred. Along the way, Sarah was introduced to the Eden Alternative, a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the well-being of elders. Sarah recognized that her values and experience encompassed Eden's mission and soon began working in tandem with them to educate and promote better elder care nationally and internationally. Sarah is a graduate of East Carolina University with a Bachelor of Science and a Master of Arts in Education. She's also a graduate of the New York City School of Life Design's Training Institute. She holds her certificate from At Ease Incorporated School for Business Protocol and Etiquette. She also served as a past member of the National Eden Board and will forever be considered an Elder of Eden. Before entering into the role of elder advocacy, Sarah was an elementary school teacher for 30 years, serving as a mentor to children and their families. And after retiring from teaching, Sarah became involved with The Crowning Touch, a company which focuses on the fine art of professional self-esteem, etiquette, and positive living. Sarah is without a doubt a woman of faith, and her outlook on life was inspired by an upbringing surrounded with love and encouragement. Would you please join me in welcoming the Sarah Rowan?
Friend, I love what you said about this one.
It's my first time in Omaha. I've never felt such love, never seen such love, never seen people that share with their hearts, with their joys, with their treasures to make a better world for us elders. It didn't take me long to become an elder. I thought it was supposed to take a long time. It was just like that. And I'm so glad I reached it. I'm an official elder, and I love it. So for all of you young people out here, keep plugging away for elderhood. You're just going to love it. I grew up as a little girl in North Carolina on a farm. In a house that had three generations of people. I thought that's the way everybody grew up. And if they didn't, I thought they should grow up that way. Because I learned so much from my grandmother. You know what she'd say sometimes, tiny little woman, when she'd walk down that long hallway? I said, "Granny, where are you going?" She said, "I'm going to find my perspective." I said, "Where did you lose it? Could I help you?" Not knowing I was the reason she had lost her perspective. And then in that household also was my uncle. And he had been in World War II, Betty. And he did not come back the same way he went in. He went in as a young student. And he came out as a post-traumatic syndrome veteran. And sometimes I wondered about my uncle. Why did he do some of the things he did? And sometimes I'd whisper it to my mother. I wonder why he says that or he's doing that. And my mother would whisper back to me, he represents the price of freedom. Betty, Chuck represents the price of freedom. His life was his message. Everywhere I go, people say, did you know Chuck? Did you know Chuck? I said, yes, I know him now through 300 different people. I know who this man is. This man has enriched my soul by his message in his life. Well, Julie talked about this woman that I hardly knew who she was introducing, you know. I usually say, I'm a retired educator. I had the privilege of teaching first graders for 30 years. And when I taught first graders, I began to think, well, I know how first graders are here in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and I know how they are here. I wonder how they would be in Europe. So I said, I'm going to figure it out. I went over there, and guess what? I taught first graders in Germany for 2 years. And I traveled all over everywhere trying to see how do they celebrate life here? What makes them sing a song? What is the song that they sing? What am I looking for when I'm here? What am I really looking for with people knowing that we're all one, no matter whether we're German, no matter whether we're wherever we come from, we really have the same hearts. During the process, I found the greatest treasure there that I wasn't even really looking for. It was just one of those favors in life that come. He was 6 foot tall. He was working on his doctorate. He was a guy from Ohio. And we fell in love. Can you believe it? Now, my mother could not believe that a little Southern girl could fall in love with a Yankee. But I did, you know. And he fell in love with me, two cultures apart, you know. And then we lived and traveled in Europe, and we taught school, and he did. He was the one that was so wise and so bright. And I was the one that was having such fun with the process of education, you know. He was doing all the hard stuff, and I was having the fun stuff. I said, I'll start him off, you finish him up. Well, so that's how we were married in Switzerland, and we came back to Ohio. I didn't even know Ohio at that time. I know it now because these good Midwestern states like Nebraska and Ohio, the people there, I didn't know what pure hearts they had. I didn't know what acts of service they gave. I didn't know that they knew how to work so hard. I didn't know that even gender did not matter. You did what needed to be done. You didn't say, that's your job. You just did what needed to be done. I loved it. From this marriage came two wonderful children, a boy and a girl. I thought this life of being highly favored will go on and on and on and on. And it has. But I'm going to tell you about a few little detours that made it even richer, that made it even sweeter. Maybe not at the time, but sweeter. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it takes to realize those things. And I learned this as even a child. When my family members would say, "You're likely to have much difficulty in life unless you have the three essential bones." I learned that first as a child. Didn't know what it meant. I had two sisters. I have a twin. I have a sister that's 3 years older. And when I first was posed that question, "You're likely to have difficulty unless you have the three essential bones," I said, "I hope I have them. I don't know what they are." I know my sisters have them. I don't question that. I know they have them. But I just hope I have at least one of them. And then I began to learn what they were. The first essential bone, and you have it. You don't even have to worry about it. You don't even have to ask yourself if you... It's the backbone. You have it. And I began to see who else had good, solid backbones, you know. And I began to see that that solid backbone would keep you going when you felt like you needed to bend over. That solid backbone would get you back up there and make you keep walking that path. I began to see people that I thought had great backbone. You know what? I saw it in my mother. When I was 10 years old, going on 11, and my happy family lived together, learning and growing and being. My dad would take us often to school. And on this particular Tuesday, he took us. We got out running little children to their school. We went back and said, "Bye, Dad, we've got to tell you we love you." The next time we talked to our dad, actually, the next time we heard about my dad was coming home that afternoon from playing with a little friend when a call came and said, "Twins, your mother would like to have you at your home. She's not there now, but she'll be home tonight. She wants you home." And I told you we lived in a country home. And in that community were caring people like you. And when we got back to our country home, it was filled with cars, and it was filled with people. But actually, before we even got there, the radio was on in my uncle's car. And my twin said, "Is that Daddy?" Because the radio had said, "Mr. Adrian McRae has been in a serious accident." When we got there, all of you caring people were there. And my 10-year-old heart thought, "Oh my gosh, all of you just showed up and my mom and dad aren't here." They're not even here to see all these people that just showed up. So I said to my twin, and they were telling stories about things that happened as little girls, things that I had never heard. Why, the postman even said, "I bet you didn't know that on the day you were born, my job was not only to deliver the mail, but to knock on the door and say, 'The McRae's had twin baby daughters born today.'" I said to my sisters, "I'm going to remember that story and tell Mom and Dad. I bet they don't know that." And there were so many other stories. And I said, "I think I can remember six," to my twin. "Mary, let's try to remember. You remember six, I remember six, that's 12. Darcy, you're older, could you remember more?" Oh, my gosh. We had those stories all in our hearts just to share when Mom and Dad came home. And nobody left. Caring people don't leave when there's trauma. They stay. They're there to heal. That's what care means, helping others to grow and heal. And when Mama walked in that door, she wasn't crying. But my dad's brother was. And he was a doctor, and he was crying. I'd never seen my Dr. Walter cry before. But Mama said, just as confident as she could, as she greeted all of you, she said, I'll need to talk to my daughters in private. And she took us into her bedroom, and she told us the story. Today at 3 o'clock, as your father crossed the street from his business, he was struck by a car driven by a drunken driver. First of all, we must forgive that man. His name is Robert Allen Butler. My little 10-year-old heart said, forgive a man that would kill my father? But Mama said, first of all, you must forgive him. She didn't stop there. Talking about backbone. She didn't stop there. She said, now we must go out and greet our guests, our loved ones who are here with us. So we prayed. She prayed the 23rd Psalm. She prayed it so beautifully, I thought I'd never heard the words like that before. But I was 10 years old, so I didn't really understand all of it. But she said, now, girls, your job is to help me prepare this celebration. This celebration from home to home. And she needed our help. She wanted us to be included in preparing the celebration. And then after she talked about that, she said, now let's go out and greet our guests and ask them to prayerfully join us as we wake up tomorrow and start again. You know people with backbone too. You are people with backbone. You have one of the essential bones. Now, I didn't even know what my mother was teaching me then. I've had to learn it. I've had to say, oh my gosh, that's about the backbone. Sarah, you're getting it. You're getting a little backbone. Welcome that experience. You're getting a little backbone. Now, the second essential bone that they talk about is a wishbone. Have a wish that is so big that bone cannot be broken. If you have the wish, it will become the dream. And the dream will come to fruition. It will be revealed itself. It will reveal itself in so many ways you did not think that it's being revealed, the dream, till it becomes a reality. Look at where we are right now. I mean, look at Julie Masters and what she has done today. I mean, to get me a little first grade teacher from North Carolina and come and be with you esteemed people. Thank you, Julie. I mean, this was a dream. I didn't even know to dream. Now, the third is the funny bone. That's the one I really love, is the funny bone. Because if you cannot see humor in your life, turn around and review it. Because there's so many things that are going to teach you about humor and funny things that you never even saw. You'll learn to laugh at yourself. That'll be the biggest thing that you think is funny. But when I had a chance to really learn about the funny bone, again, it happened to be a lot of it came from my husband as he was walking with forgetfulness. He wasn't trying to be funny, but he had the best sense of humor you've ever seen when he walked with forgetfulness. And I can remember that when I didn't see things as funny, love kept popping up and walking you through step by step by step through the impossibility of it all. So love is the common denominator that makes everything happen. Love is the common denominator that manifests. And when love is the purpose and the dream, don't you ever worry about the success of it. It will be there. People will beat a path to your door where love is, genuine love and concern. Now, not only did I see that from my family and elders, but I saw it from the children that I taught that were so spontaneous in their love. And if you have never been adored, become a first grade teacher. You will be adored. I mean, they want to sit right beside you, stroke your face, tell you you're beautiful, you smell good. I mean, it's just so wonderful. Now, and I had that privilege for 30 years. And I used to dream what will happen in their life. Because where I taught, it wasn't a school of the favored. It was a school that probably didn't have the opportunities that I wished they could have all had. And I had a little student come back one day, and he knocked at the door, and he'd already graduated, and my husband was there, and my husband was a professor. And he said, "My name is Paul. I'm just coming to check on Mrs. Roy and see how she is." He said, "I don't remember too much about what she taught me. I just remember how good I felt when I felt. He said, "You know, she called me Winnie the Pooh sometime. I'll never forget it. No one has ever really tried to make me feel so good as Mrs. Roy." Now, like I said, I don't remember too much what I learned. My husband thought I was a failure that I had not taught him the facts, because he was a professor and he was teaching the facts. But let me tell you, there came a time after he had taught nearly 30 years that the facts were getting confused. He didn't seem to realize it too much, but I began to realize it. I didn't even want to realize it. I wanted to deny the whole thing. I didn't want to admit. I began to say, "Oh, no, Sarah, it's you. It's the way you're viewing things. Because tomorrow would be a good day. And maybe the next day would be a good day." But there was no confusing about Friday. It was facts that I had to learn to deal with. And I began to say, "I wish I had known you then. But I know you now, that's enough. Will you take care of me when I walk with forgetfulness?" So when I began to say, because he was much wiser than I, and so he retired and he said, "Sarah, it's time for you to retire. We are retiring." And I said, "But I love what I'm doing." He said, "That's when you need to retire." I told you he was a wise man. He said, "You need to retire when they love you and you love them. That's when you're to retire." So I retired. And maybe it was because I had retired that I began to see things that I probably missed, that were things that the backs weren't right. And I remember saying one day, Joseph, maybe we should go to get a medical examination now that we're retired. He might have said, I'm not going, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm perfectly happy. But this day, he said, that is a wonderful idea. Why didn't you think of it earlier? I called the Cleveland Clinic. I talked with people like you. And I whispered as if I did not want the world to know. I whispered to the geriatric head of the department, I think my husband has something called dementia, but I'm not sure. And if I were to mention that, he wouldn't agree, and I'm sort of frightened to think, but what do I do? He said, make an appointment. So simple. And we made an appointment. And on the day that we were to go, I kept reviewing. Joseph, that was the best idea you had about having a medical examination when we were retiring. We're going to the Cleveland Clinic, and we're going Tuesday. And I thought, I better remind him, because suppose he changes his mind. And he did sometimes, you know. And I didn't want to have to say, no, you're going. I knew how to say that. But I don't like saying things like that to people I love. You don't either. So on the day that we were driving up to the Cleveland Clinic, he was singing a song. And I was humming, but below the hum, I was thinking, how will it be? What will they say? Julie and I were talking earlier on the day they gave her father the clock test. Now, I could be with Joseph, but I couldn't be with him all the time that they were doing these tests. But I could be there for the clock test. And they said, Dr. Rowan, some of the things we're going to tell you sort of seem sort of silly to you, a professor. He says, but I hope you'll play the game with us anyway. And they said, could you draw a clock on this piece of paper? He said, what kind of clock do you want? Grandfather clock, alarm clock, wristwatch. Tell me what kind of clock you want. And they said, oh, it really doesn't matter, just a clock. And he pondered, just a clock. And then they said, oh, just draw a circle, just the face of a clock. I was so glad they asked him that, because he was good at drawing. And he drew the perfect circle. It even connected perfectly at the top. And then they said, now, good job, put numbers on the clock. And he said, numbers? Now, here was a man that recognized people, was enjoying life. It made me realize how hard he was working to make order of his world. And how little I knew about how hard he was working to make his world normal. But when they said put numbers on the clock, after that perfect circle, he said, what kind of numbers? They said, oh, just 12, 1, 2, 3. So here is the perfect circle. And down below that, he began to put 12, 1, 2, 3. He said, you want me to turn it over and put some more numbers on the other side? They said, oh, no, that's a perfect clock. But I knew it wasn't the perfect clock. And so I began to think, what can I do to show him every day I love him more than the day before? Now, I shouldn't be embarrassed to tell you, I didn't do that too much before that came to my realization. Sometimes I'd forgotten to tell the man I love you more every day. But the clock awakened this. He loved nature. He loved picnics. He loved doing all these things. So I thought, at least twice a week, I'm going to have a date that is just so sensational with my husband. Something that will just reconnect his memory to what was perfect in his life. And I remember the first day that I took him onto this picnic. It was such a gorgeous garden. Remind me of the Chihuly Garden this morning that we saw. You know, you could just walk there. But I had this little picnic lunch, and he walked away from me, and he had a little fork from the picnic. And he walked way back in the little part of the garden. And I could see him kneeling with this little fork and digging something in the garden. And he came back with two little twigs, little saplings. And he said, "Here, my sweetheart, these are yours." He presented them like they were gold and silver and platinum all together. He said, "These are yours." He said, "I had to work very hard to dig them up. They were crushed between two little stones, but I wanted you to have them." And I took those little treasures, and I put them in the little paper cup, and I said, "My Joseph, what makes you the miracle that you are?" You know what he said? He repeated it. He said, "What makes you the miracle that you are?" It fell into my spirit that every word I said to anyone, if every word I said were whispered back to me, would I feel just celebrated? Or would I feel just tolerated? I knew then, he had taught me well. I knew then that our words are probably the most powerful thing we possess. Our words are the greatest tool we will ever use in our repertoire of tools in our life. I then realized that my words would create the climate of his day. I realized that my words had tremendous power to make my husband's life joyous or miserable. I learned that my words could be for him a tool of torture, or my words could be an instrument of inspiration. Never had I really thought about our words. I realized that my words could humiliate or humor, hurt or heal, and that it would be my words that would decide whether a crisis would be escalated or de-escalated, and my loved one humanized or dehumanized. You know that better than I. It's what you do. It's what you do. It's what you were born to do, to care, to love, to help another grow. especially if they're in crisis. Many times we're in crisis and we don't even know we're in crisis. It's then that I began to think, Sarah, no matter what you possess, it will never be as important as the words that you speak. It's the same for you. You speak words of healing, words of comfort. I mean, I'm so impressed with what I find through you holy people doing holy work. We don't realize we are holy people doing holy work. It's our assignment in life. And I'm telling you, you're getting A+ on your grade. You're getting A+ on your grade. So when you do this type of thing, you don't realize that actually you're human sanctuary to people. So if I called you, you are human sanctuary. Now, when you are a human sanctuary, like you are, you don't realize it because you only see the foibles, the mistakes, the things that you do. But other people come to you because they see you caring, loving, helping them grow. Thank you. You're a human sanctuary. Now, when you wake up tomorrow morning, I want you to look in that mirror and you say, I am human sanctuary. I know you're not going to do it, but try it. Now, also, there was a day after the clock drawing that there comes a diagnosis. Now, I already knew something was not right, but it didn't have a name. Do you know, you doctors that are in here, let me tell you, I give thanks for the way you can tell a person in crisis bad news in a beautiful way. Now, I'm going to repeat that. Bad news in a beautiful way. That's what I was told with my husband. Bad news, but in a beautiful way. I found myself thanking the doctor for telling me, because he said it in such a beautiful way. And after he told my husband, because he felt maybe I would understand, but he wanted my husband to understand, the curriculum is changing. And on the day when the curriculum changed, and that news was told to my PhD husband, you know what he said? I question your diagnosis. And this man that said bad news in a beautiful way said, oh, Dr. Rowan, you may. That's all right. He didn't get upset about it. He said, you may question it. But tests are rather conclusive that even though you are a perfectly physically healthy man, well, I only detect a little rheumatism or arthritis in the little pinky finger. Other than that, you are perfectly physically healthy. However, in the neurocognitive area, you have something we feel will be Alzheimer's, dementia of the Alzheimer's type. It had a name. I came home that day with a husband that had a title with a new name. I just thought he was walking with forgetfulness. And And I wanted to continue to know he was walking with forgetfulness. I didn't even like to use the diagnosed title of dementia of the Alzheimer's variety, because I didn't like labels. I had been a school teacher when labels had sometimes been put on a child that was just fearful or just not ready to learn. So I didn't like labels, so I began to think, oh no, he's just walking with forgetfulness. And this is going to be a great walk. Because, you know, my husband knew the facts. He knew how to give the best. He would give me a C minus or a D on this lecture because I am not giving the facts. I'm giving the stories. But he would give the facts. And so I began to see when the curriculum changed. He wasn't interested in the facts. He was living in the moment. He was living with such spontaneity and joy. I was having the best time you've ever seen. He was just having such fun. And I began to think, oh my gosh, I'm at least going to take him to all the things. And we traveled. I mean, we went to Greece. He got lost 7 times. But, you know, but we got back together. He didn't know he was lost. I was the only one that knew he was lost, you know. So we came back, and I began to say, oh, what can I take him to spark a memory, and to just get these links erased that are called these tangles in his brain. And he loved the Cleveland Indians baseball. So they had a good team that year. By the way, they've won 22 straight this year. And I did not even know the difference from baseball and football or soccer. I don't know too much about that. But he did, so it was important for me to learn. And I took him to the baseball game. And I do know when a home run is hit. And so that happened the first inning, and I stood up and started clapping like this. He took my shirt and he said, "Sarah, I think you should sit down. You're making too much noise." Now, this man that had just clapped and applauded when they didn't have a win for 4 years, you know. He was still in there. He said, "Sit down, you're making too much noise." And then it was about the halftime. We were singing with such gusto, you know, "Take me out to the ball game." And all of a sudden, after we sat down, he said, "I don't think any of this is relevant. I'd rather go back home." So we went back home. I turned on the radio. They were still winning. I said, "Joseph, these Cleveland Indians are going to be pennant winners this year." I was so proud of my vocabulary. When his response was, "Well, it's all right." I said, "What did you think about it?" He said, "I'd rather have seen baseball." I said, "Next time we will." I could have gotten into a rip-snoring fight about this thing, you know. "What do you mean? I've been here at ballgame." It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. You don't have to have the last word. You don't have the last word. So you know what? The next day I decided, well, he liked that picnic so much, I'm going to take him to the Cleveland Art Museum because he loved art. I'm going to take him there. And it was heavy construction like you have around here too. And there were these big barriers. When this steel truck was coming by in front of us, and a big steel bar dropped off the truck, flattened both of our front tires, these construction things right beside us, I knew I couldn't stop. My husband was playing his harmonica. He didn't even know it had happened. And the construction worker said, "Lady, don't stop. You'll be hit. Go on down a quarter of a mile and turn off." So I went down a quarter of a mile and I turned off. And as soon as the car stopped, limped to a stop, my husband said, "Why are we stopping?" He didn't even know the trauma that we'd all been in. He said, "Why are we stopping?" I said, "We're going to have a picnic." He said, "I don't want to have a picnic." Here, parked by the road. I said, "You're going to love this one. We have never had a picnic like this before. You are going to love this picnic." I said, "It's called a water picnic. You take the water, I'll take the blanket, you take your harmonica. We are going to love this water picnic." We climbed the hill. We sat on the blanket. He played his harmonica. I called AAA. They came in 43 minutes. But I had a wonderful concert. They couldn't bring the car back. They had to put it on the tow truck. We had to get in front with the driver. The whole time he was playing the harmonica. He didn't know anything had changed. It was only me that could see this as trauma. He didn't know it had changed. So it would be my response that decided whether this was traumatic to him or not. When we got in the truck, and I just sort of put my head, I knew he couldn't get out. I knew the man was talking. He was nice. I just sort of put my head back and said, oh, thank you, Lord, thank you. We got back home. I was hoping he'd be ready for a nap. He put his arms around me with a big hug, and he said, I love that water picnic. He said, I hope we can take more of these water picnics. Simple as a water picnic. It doesn't take much. When I went to engage today, I thought, oh my gosh, my husband would have loved this. Because when I was talking to him just that day of diagnosis, about the diagnosis, he said to me, Sarah, you know, it's just what I've always told you. If you would exercise and take care of yourself, you'd have the same good diagnosis I have. Just a little arthritis in the finger. So the rest of the story was not as much up to him as it was up to me. Now, the story continues. And I'd like to have it an ending that says, and he lived happily ever after. The Alzheimer's left. We began living a life with great favor. But you know, that story doesn't end that way. And there came to a point that his care needed to be probably more than I was qualified or could care for him in our home. See, I didn't know home instead at that time. Now I do. My children aren't going to have the burden that I had. Not burden, the joy that I had. But they're not going to have the burden with me because they're younger. And you know what I've already told them? I told this to Julie too. I'm afraid I'm going to live till everybody regrets it. I'm sorry about it. I think I'm not going to have a thing to do about it. I'm afraid that's what it is. I've already informed them. I says, but I do know good people that will know how to take care of me. You know. Don't feel like you have to do that. And I trust you to make those decisions. Well, so it came that Joseph needed a care that he wasn't able to get at home. I took him to a place in South Carolina, not knowing, would it be better? Would it be worse? I'm transitioning him. I'm uprooting him. I'm leaving one home, going to another place to be with him. But we did it. And on the day that I drove him there, we arrived at about 10:30 at night, one day, 720 miles. I was so excited. I was trying to get there because I knew when I spent the night with sometimes, and it was in a hotel or a motel or whatever it was, he would say, this is not my home. I want to go home. And I thought he'd go without me. So I wanted to get him there in one day. And when we got there, his care partners were there waiting for him. It was dark. And he saw a little dog outside the door. And the miracle of miracles, it was like our little Shelty dog that we had just left in Ohio. He looked down at his dog, Mac, and he said, Mac, what are you doing out here at night? Let me take you to bed. We showed him the bed. He went to sleep with Mac, Miss Stella was her name, Miss Stella on his chest. He never knew he had transitioned. It's where I met Denise Hyde for the Eden Alternative. It's where I met Dr. Bill Thomas, who said, Sarah, come and tell a story about this. It's where the first Eden Alternative became the International Eden Alternative. And I thought, what can I share? And I'm sharing it with you. My husband loved art and he loved to draw. And on one day on our kitchen table, he was drawing. Three paintings he had finished. He had told me all about them. They were so beautiful. And my job was to make sure when I saw he was tired or the work was finished, to remove the paint and to remove the brushes. If not, he'd paint his face, paint his ears, paint his clothes. He was an artist. So this day, as the paintings were finished, and I was removing the paints, he was busy tearing them up and putting them on the table, saying, here, my sweetheart, here's a piece of our lives. Here, my sweetheart, here's a piece of our lives. And I looked at the pieces of our lives, and I said, my Joseph, I never knew we had so many beautiful pieces of our lives. Let's put them back together. So we did, and it became a big collage that represented the pieces of our lives. I'd love to know about the pieces of your lives. You probably have not even thought, I had not even thought about the pieces of our lives. The place that he went to in South Carolina, he became a professor again. I didn't really know that until I met a man in a place 3 years after actually his death. And it was a situation where I saw that this man was developing dementia. And I saw him trying to pay his light bill. But he had failed to meet the payments, and his light bill was going to be, his lights were going to be turned off. So as I heard the discussion, I walked up to the other side of the desk because there weren't many people there, and I said, excuse me, I don't want to be intrusive, but I understood his story, and could I have the privilege of paying his bill? She said, I'd have to ask the supervisor. And I said, well, if you'd ask the supervisor if I could have the privilege of paying for his bill. So his bill was a certain amount. My bill was a certain amount. So I walked over to him and I said, I heard you say that. I get confused like that sometimes. Could I have the privilege of paying your bill today? He said, are you sure? I said, well, yes, it's just a miracle that we're here together today and I would have this privilege. So it happened. I was walking out. He said, by the way, do you have a name? I said, yes, my name is Sarah. And I wrote it on the back of his bill. He said, do you have a number? And I wrote it. That night on my answer machine said, my name is Mr. Willie. You paid my bill. If I can do anything for you, I will. And then it clicked off. Then right after it, another one said, my name is Mr. Willie. I'm calling to thank you again. I want to do everything I can for you, and if that ain't good enough, I'll do more. And then a third call said, my name is Cecilia. You paid a bill for my father today. We all thank you, and we'd like to invite you to come out to our home tomorrow for lunch, or come out for lunch. So I called her back and I said, I'm ready anytime. She said, could you come tomorrow? I went to their home. And I said, oh, Mr. Willie, what a miracle that is that we had a chance to meet. I said, tell me what you did and tell me what you do. And he said, well, I'll tell you this, Miss Sarah. He said, I worked for really special people. He said they had a philosophy of care that you take care of loneliness, helplessness, and boredom. And I thought, oh my gosh, could it be that he was at the home where my husband was? And I said, Mr. Willie, was that at a place called Maddie C. Hall? He said, oh, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am. I said, did you happen to know a person there named Dr. Joseph Rowan? He said, oh, yes, ma'am, everybody knew him. He said he was a professor. He said he'd get on the lecture every day and said, I'd like for the class to be quiet. We have some important things to learn. And said he taught us all about the Titanic. He taught us about all things. He says, but when it was ready to finish, he said, he would play his harmonica. And then he'd say, class dismissed. And then he would go over to the aquarium and drop it in the aquarium. And he said, my job was to fish the harmonica out of the aquarium and get it ready for tomorrow's lecture. Now, that's what you do. That's what you do, caring people. You fish the harmonica out of the aquarium and get it ready for tomorrow. I once met a man who had a bowl like this. And he was bowing reverently. And it was in a foreign country. And he was saying words that you knew meant love and unity and all these things. But I thought, he's a stranger in my midst. And then I would see somebody come by and maybe drop a coin in there. And if they did, he would lift the coin up as if giving thanks, brush it off, and put it in his pocket. Maybe somebody would come and give just a morsel of food. And that little morsel, he would take out and devour it. And when I saw this little bowl of that man, I thought, oh, he's a beggar. And my heart began to think, oh, yeah, he's a beggar. But my compassionate heart said, aren't we all? When you give a morsel of kindness to the loved starved, you are giving a feast. Thank you for giving your love away.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Sarah Rowan, former first grade teacher and member of the executive board of Eden Alternative, a national nonprofit that seeks to improve the lives of elders and their caregivers through education, consultation, and outreach. This program, given as the annual Dr. Chuck Powell Memorial Lecture, presented by the Department of Gerontology at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, October 2, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, Associate Director of Media Relations in the University of Nebraska at Omaha Office of University Communications, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.